from KQED.
From KQED Public Radio in San Francisco, I'm Dave Iverson. Solar proponents from around the world gathered in San Francisco this week for the InterSolar North America Conference and Expo to talk about the state of the industry and show off the latest solar technology. California is front and center in the solar world, of course, because of landmark legislation which requires that a third of the state's electricity come from renewable sources by the year 2020. But a combination of economic, political, and regulatory forces are cooling some of solar's immediate prospects. In the hour ahead, we'll get the latest on solar technology and the challenges to its future. That's next on Forum, after this. From KQED Public Radio in San Francisco, I'm Dave Iverson, in this week for Michael Krasny. Yesterday, California State Attorney General Jerry Brown said he was taking federal regulators to court. Brown is unhappy that the Federal Housing Finance Agency is blocking a popular program used to finance solar panel installations and home energy retrofits. The agency, along with Freddie Mac and Fannie Mae, the federally banked mortgage giants, think the financing of that program is too risky. In essence, the program allows homeowners to borrow the money to finance those home energy improvements, then pay it back through an additional assessment on their property taxes. The feds think in today's fragile housing market, that kind of financing is too risky. Halting the program would not only slow those home energy improvements, but it could also have a major impact on the solar industry and the jobs that industry would like to create. The dispute is just one example of the push and pull in the solar industry these days. There's high interest and demand for solar. In fact, a major international conference on solar power is taking place in San Francisco all this week. But the political, economic, and regulatory environment are much more uncertain. And that's the topic we tackle in this first hour of Forum. Joining us to do so, Todd Woody. He's a journalist who's covering environmental issues for The New York Times, The Los Angeles Times, and Grist. Todd, good morning. Also joining us, Eike Weber. He is the director of the Fraunhofer Institute for Solar Energy Systems in Germany, one of the world's leading solar energy research organizations. And he's also the chairman of the InterSolar North America Conference, the conference that's taking place this week in San Francisco. Good morning.
Good morning, David.
Danny Kennedy is here, too. He's president and co-founder of Sungevity, a Berkeley-based residential solar installation company. Danny, good morning.
Hello.
And joining us by phone this morning, Severin Bornstein. He's professor at the University of California, Berkeley's Haas School of Business and co-director of the Energy Institute at the Haas School. Professor Bornstein, good morning.
Good morning.
Thanks all for joining us. It seems like in some ways, Todd Woody, that this is kind of the best of times and the worst of times for the solar industry, that there's high interest, a lot of focus and demand and energy into this particular topic. And yet at the same time, as I mentioned in the introduction, there's a lot of other regulatory and political forces that are going forward that are not as conducive to the growth of solar. Walk us through this lawsuit that the Attorney General is bringing forward and why that's so significant potentially for the development of solar.
Well, the PACE program has been seen as a chance to really scale up solar to the point where it can become more economically viable without subsidies. 22 states have authorized PACE programs over the past year or so, and a number of big programs are just about ready to be rolled out, particularly in California, from the cities of Los Angeles and San Diego. So when Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac sort of threw a spanner in the works, it's caused a huge degree of concern from the governor of California to the mayor of New York to various congresspeople. The beauty of PACE is that it allows people to basically install solar and make energy efficiency upgrades with no money down.
So basically, they're able to borrow the money and then pay it back through an extra add-on to their property taxes.
Yes, and the other significant aspect of this, if you sell your house, that property tax assessment just rolls over to the new owner. So you don't have to worry about being on the hook for that money.
And explain the rationale from the federal side, why they thought that this manner of putting forward solar installation was too risky in today's housing market.
Well, here's where the interesting part is. The Obama administration has supported PACE programs. In fact, has allocated $150 million toward those programs. It's Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac, which are government-chartered mortgage companies, essentially. Government-chartered but privately held. They sent out a letter out May 5th saying, we think because PACE programs put a lien on your house, just like any other property assessment, which gets paid first if the homeowner defaults.
So if there's a foreclosure, the money would first go towards paying that back.
Yes. And Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac sent letters out to their lenders saying, we think this probably would violate our standards. However, they offer no guidance for the banks what to do about this. That basically froze the programs because no local government wanted to put their homeowners in danger of being in violation of their mortgage. Then on July 6th, the Federal Housing Finance Agency, which oversees Fannie and Freddie, issued guidance finally and said, basically, we stand by those letters and they offered a whole new set of restrictions for homeowners. That has, in practical effect, derailed the entire programs.
And what does the Attorney General, Jerry Brown, and of course, Democratic candidate for governor, think is the legal issue? What can he do in terms of taking this to court?
The suit alleges that they have violated California law. PACE programs in California are authorized by state law. And he's offered a very interesting cause of action. He says the federal government, or Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac, have violated environmental law, a national environmental law that requires an environmental impact statement be prepared for any federal action that has major environmental consequences. Mm. And he's saying by derailing PACE in California, the preventing people from promoting renewable energy, meeting various state mandates, creating green jobs, and that they should prepare this report first.
So that's the lay of the land as we know it right now. And I want to get reaction from our other guests to the pros and cons of this, both the impact that this could have on the solar industry, but the wisdom of the regulatory decision itself. Severin Bornstein, as you look at this decision by the federal regulators and the challenge to it now from Attorney General Brown, what's your reaction?
Well, I'm not very surprised. From the very beginning of the PACE program introduction in Berkeley, there's been a lot of concern on lender side, because what this basically does is it allows you to take out a second mortgage but move it in front of your first mortgage in the case of default. And, of course, the holders of those first mortgages are never happy about that, and so they have resisted it. In practice, though, you know, well, there's a lot of talk about the PACE program having a huge impact. The Berkeley program was pretty much of a bust. Almost no one took up this financing because it was actually turned out to be more expensive than the alternatives they could access. So I'm skeptical that the PACE program really is going to launch the solar industry in any significant way.
Why was it more expensive to go through this? It would seem like this would be something that would presumably homeowners would be able to get this money at a low interest rate, and that it would be an easy way then to repay it through a property tax assessment.
Well, that's true, but these are homeowners who, for the most part, do have equity in their homes,
yeah,
and they have alternative financing through second mortgages. Now, the city or the government entity can probably do a bit better than that, but on the other hand, the government entity has their own overhead and their own concerns about making sure they cover their costs. The rates that Berkeley ended up offering and that have been offered in many other programs that are discussed, at least, really aren't competitive with alternative financing that many of these homeowners can access.
So
but I think there's another point, which is that the whole notion for PACE funding solar is that the main barrier for most people adopting solar is that they just don't have the upfront financing, that in the long run it'll save them money, but they just can't put together the capital. And unfortunately, that's just not true. Most homeowners will not save money by installing solar PV today. Solar PV is a great technology, but it's still pretty cost ineffective, except in areas where electricity is just wildly expensive. Now, PG&E, our local utility, if you are a major energy user, if you are consuming three times the baseline level or more, it's charging almost 50 cents a kilowatt hour for power. At those rates, solar can be pretty competitive. But for a typical homeowner, you really just are never going to make your money back.
Severin Bornstein, professor at the University of California, Berkeley's Haas School of Business and co-director of the Energy Institute at Haas. I want to get to Severin Bornstein's sense of the economics of solar power in a moment. But before we do that, I want to hear from Danny Kennedy about the impact of the PACE, the hold on the PACE funds on your business, on your business, on Sungevity, which installs these solar panels in people's homes. You heard Severin Borenstein say that, you know, as much as he might like solar, he understands why the regulators would say, you know, this is kind of a risky proposition, that makes sense. How do you respond to it?
Well, I'm glad you want to get back to the broader solar economics, because I don't think what Severin just said is true. Most Californians can save money with a solar system on their home. But as far as pace goes, I can agree with him that it was not ideal for all homeowners. We, Sungevity, sold the first Berkeley First system, the initial PACE sale, and we're happy to do so and happy to offer it as one of the options to get rid of this capital upfront cost to go solar. And it's a really good construct for some people that own their home and want just sort of no hassle payments as you go through the 20-year program. It's true that the cost of money was possibly too high for a lot of people for massive uptake. But, you know, Sonoma County has sold, I think, up to 1,000 systems on this program. Boulder County in Colorado, many hundreds of people have benefited from it. So it certainly was helping spread solar by getting rid of that barrier of the upfront capital cost.
But it sounds like you think it's just sort of one arrow in the quiver, that there are a lot of other ways you can accomplish it, and it going away doesn't necessarily mean that people can't go in that direction.
It's true that it's one arrow in the quiver, and we were happy to provide a smorgasbord of options. Some people have the cash to pay up front if they've got that sort of money in their bank, and that's good economics too. Some people prefer the lease we offer. Sungevity has a solar lease where we own the system and they pay us for the electricity. Some people prefer to put it on their property tax bill and pay it every 6 months. So it's good to have options. That's important for a market to mature, and that's what's been happening. And the great shame here is that the federal government is sort of doing with the left hand to stop what the right hand's trying to do. You know, there's all this rhetoric about we want the clean economy to grow.
Yeah.
We're putting $150 million down on this program. And then over here on the other flank, there's an agency saying this doesn't work because of some fairly specious argument, in my view. You know, there's many improvement districts that are funded through property tax assessment. You know, this is how America laid sewers and lighting in the streets. So why can't we spread solar with this program if the community chooses to opt for it? It's just another option for financing this incredible technology that does actually save money for the customer.
Well, let's go to that, and we'll return to the PACE program and the Attorney General's potential lawsuit as we go throughout the hour. And if listeners have particular questions about that, we'll get to those as well. But Severin Borenstein is making the argument, it sounds like, Danny Kennedy and also Professor Akiveba, that it doesn't make sense. You know, it sounds swell, but right now the cost of it, the economics don't work. Danny Kennedy.
I thought that might come up, so I just crunched some numbers before coming here. Over the last 500 systems we've sold in California, Colorado, and Arizona, mostly on the lease, the customers are saving money. 60% of them are saving money month one with our lease, ranging from $10 to $400 a month. We're putting cash in people's pocket in the middle of a recession by going solar.
How long does it take before the economics make sense? Because there is a significant – well, let's walk through the cost.
Okay,
what is the cost? If I wanted to put solar in my house, what is it cost?
Zero. You get a lease for no money down. So you sign the contract with us, a 10-year lease, and you pay us a monthly payment, which is performance guaranteed. And that monthly payment is, in most cases, 60% of Californians, less than what they pay their utility currently. And it's not just PG&E, to Severin's point. It's all the big investor-owned utilities, but it's even the publicly-owned utilities.
So your argument would be you can make money from the get-go.
Absolutely, because what Severin misunderstands is apples to oranges. He's saying the wholesale rate of electricity, PV, photovoltaics are not competitive. But at the point of use, above your roof or his roof in Arinda, where he's probably sucking out air conditioning, he may be one of those consumers being charged the third, fourth, or fifth tier of the rate structure. That's expensive electricity. Our electricity is cheaper. We're selling electricity below 20 cents a kilowatt hour. If you look at your bill, you're being charged in most of the western states more than 20 cents a kilowatt hour for residential electricity.
I want to give Professor Borenstein a chance to respond, but before I do, I could ever join into the conversation if you would as well. Again, he's the director of the Fraunhofer Institute for Solar Energy Systems in Germany, once taught here at UC Berkeley, so a colleague of Severin Borenstein's, and is also chairing the international conference that's taking place this week in San Francisco. Your view on the economics of this, because really, if you can't win this argument, you're not going to win.
As a matter of fact, I think the economics of it right now in California are already very attractive, and they will get more attractive by the year because the cost of photovoltaics is coming down each year.
And when
year.
We say photovoltaics, just for the uninitiated in this topic, we're talking about the actual cells that are part of the panels that you put on your roof.
Yes. I mean, if you want to convert solar energy into electricity, we have two ways. We can do it in solar thermal power plants, which you only can do in huge installations like we have it here in the Mojave Desert. But the more attractive way and down the road financially much more interesting way is the direct conversion of sunlight by the help of a semiconductor device, which is simply the inverted light-emitting diode. Light-emitting diode is current in, light out. A solar cell is light in, electricity out. And because we are piggybacking on 20, 30 years of semiconductor technology, the prices of creating electricity from sunlight in this way are coming down exactly as you said. In Sunridge, California, 15 to 20 cents a kilowatt hour, which is already now absolutely competitive, and it will get more competitive by the year.
Well, you know, I have to say this confuses me, because this is one of these things where this shouldn't be a matter of opinion, right? This should be a matter of math. Right. So Severin Bornstein, weigh in, and then Todd Woody, maybe I'll ask you to be the arbiter here. But Severin Bornstein, respond to what Danny Kennedy and your colleague Eike Weber are saying.
Okay, let me first say that Danny said that most people are paying 20 cents a kilowatt hour. The average retail price of electricity, even for PG&E, which is one of the most expensive utilities in the West, is less than 20 cents a kilowatt hour. So it's just not the right comparison. It is true that if you're out on the fifth tier in PG&E, you're paying much, much higher.
And by fifth tier?
We have an increasing block rate structure so that if you're a very heavy consumer, you pay a much higher price for those extra kilowatt hours.
Okay.
That isn't the true cost of producing that electricity. That's helping to pay for the California electricity crisis, infrastructure investment, and so forth. If you don't pay for that, somebody else has to. That creates a revenue shortfall that eventually is borne by everyone else. So it is true that for some people, and I said this at the beginning, it will be privately economic to put these in. Mm. Now, because of the extremely heavy subsidies that we are now seeing out of the federal government, what they did is they expanded what used to be a maximum $2,000 tax credit to be 30% of your entire system, plus the state subsidies. It does make sense for some people, but again, those subsidies are not money created out of thin air. Some of those subsidies are being paid for through our tax bills, and some of them are being paid for through our electric bills. We do need to put greater emphasis on renewable energy, and I am a big advocate of renewable energy. But what we have done here is we have put our thumb on the scale, in particular for solar PV. Solar PV is getting a much heavier subsidy than wind, than solar thermal, than geothermal, than the other alternatives. What we really need to do to have a cost-effective alternative energy program is not put our thumb on the scale for one technology or another, but go after the lowest cost ways of replacing fossil fuels with renewables. So this isn't a matter of, are we valuing getting rid of CO2 enough, because all of those things get rid of CO2. It's a matter of doing it in the most cost-effective way. And right now, solar PV is not the most cost-effective way. I very much agree with Professor Weber that it's going to get cheaper. It is getting cheaper, but it's still more expensive than the other technologies, particularly at the residential level.
And again, solar PV is the photovoltaic system of creating solar, and we'll get to that too, about whether or not, as Professor Bornstein is suggesting, there's sort of a favoritism that is helping that particular kind of renewable energy versus others. I know you want to chime in, Professor Weber, and I'll get to you in just a sec, but Todd Woody, if you would, can you help us sort through the math? I mean, it sounds like it might make sense in individual cases, but Severin Bornstein is making the argument that it only makes sense because of subsidies and other things, and that's not free money.
I would just point out that all forms of energy are subsidized, including fossil fuels. So, I mean, we could have that debate, but we're really looking at what the state goals are. And solar is heavily subsidized in California. Basically, half the cost of a retail system will be kicked back to you.
Through those tax credits.
Through the state and federal tax credits. But you know, I'm not an economist, I'm not going to go through the numbers, but I will point out it's hard to have a one-size-fits-all. If you live in the desert and you have a huge air conditioning bill, you're certainly going to make your money back much faster than if you live in Berkeley where we don't use air conditioning. But it's true, the cost curve is going down. There's been a 40% plunge in solar module prices over the past year. So the trajectory is going down, which is evidenced by the big utilities increasingly are turning to big photovoltaic power plants versus solar thermal power plants.
So the economics are going to make more and more sense as time progresses?
That is the cost curve right now, yes.
And Professor Weber, you wanted to add in?
Yes, I want to add a very important argument that my colleague, I'm retired from UC Berkeley too, Professor Bornstein, might have overlooked. And this is the issue of at what time of the day the power is produced. You see it very clearly from those folks who select to take the time of use rate. For PG&E, it is extremely costly to cover the peak load, which appears in the summer just in the middle of the day when the sun is shining most. So actually even talking about cost of power production to produce the peak kilowatt hour, the top of the peak of the year, it can cost thousands of dollars because somewhere has to be a power plant only to provide the peak of the peak. So the more we introduce solar energy usage, the better we can shave off these peaks. And actually for the next 5 to 10 years, when the cost of PV electricity is not yet below the cost of fossil energy, and it will be below the cost of fossil energy if we look at 2020 and beyond. But in the meanwhile, when we have small rates like 1%, 5%, 10% of our energy created from photovoltaics, because it shaves off the peaks, one can do the math. It is already economically for the economy as a whole right now.
Do you agree with that, Professor Bornstein, about paying attention to when the time of use question?
In fact, I have written the paper that is most often cited by the solar industry on this. It does add value to solar. It does produce more at peak times, but it certainly doesn't just produce at peak times. It realistically probably means about a 20% boost in the value of solar PV relative to just taking an average wholesale rate. But that it's really still not even close to enough to make it competitive with fossil fuels. And it's I hope that'll be true in 5 to 7 years. I think that that's probably on the very optimistic end of the range of estimates I've seen. But it certainly isn't now. And it certainly isn't competitive at the residential level with other alternative energy sources. So forget about whether you're subsidizing coal and natural gas. Just talk about other alternative energy sources. Residential solar PV is the most cost inefficient of the major sources of alternative energy.
We have to take a short break, but before we do, just a quick response, Danny Kennedy, on that point. Again, that it sounds like Severin Bornstein is making the point that we're leaning too hard on this one particular technology, giving it too many breaks.
On the contrary, we're not leaning hard enough, you know, as evidenced by PACE getting chilled by some silly action by the feds. We need all of these renewable technologies. The whole portfolio needs to be invested in order to stop the carbon pollution that's killing the planet. But this technology, the proof is in the pudding. I don't really want to get into an academic debate for the sake of your listeners. The proof is in the pudding. We're saving hundreds of Californians every month money, putting 20, 40, 50, 80 bucks a month in their pocket because our electricity costs less than the electricity they're paying for. So we can theorize here about rate structures and which portion of the bill we're taking out, which we optimize towards taking out the highest cost electricity, and we will save them money. And that's a social good, which is why the policy settings need to be directed towards solar PV, as well as the job creation. We haven't talked about that, but the density of work in PV, particularly residential, is a very good value.
We will get to that question about job creation and the potential impact of a statewide ballot proposition which may suspend California's landmark AB 32 and its impact, potential impact on the solar industry to that. We'll get to all of that when we come back. Here's the number if you want to join our conversation. It's 866-733-6786. 866-733-6786. I'm Dave Iverson, and this is Forum on KQED. Welcome back to Forum. I'm Dave Iverson, in this week for Michael Krasny. Our topic this hour, the State of Solar, a big international conference, has been going on all week long in San Francisco. There have also been some regulatory developments and a lawsuit being filed by the state's attorney general that have to do with a program that makes solar installation and other kinds of energy retrofitting more available to consumers. And so we've focused on that as well. We welcome your focus. What do you think of this discussion? Where would you like to see the focus of energy go in the future? The number, if you want to join us, 866-733-6786. Email us at forum@kqed.org, or you can go to our website, kqed.org/forum, and add your comment there, and we'll get that online. Let me go through a couple of comments that are already coming in, and then we'll get to our calls. Lynn writes in, it seems like the focus of Severin Bornstein's comments and the program overall is on solar installations. However, it's important to note that PACE, that's the program that is making these improvements available through the program we were discussing earlier. Lynn writes, PACE is not just designed for solar financing, but also for energy efficiency improvements, which in most cases are cost effective. So please don't lose sight of that part of the discussion. Let's hear what our callers are thinking about this topic this morning. We'll go first to Paul in Santa Cruz. Paul, go ahead.
Hi there. As a consumer, I mean, I love hearing what you guys are saying about the PACE program and what it offers for solar installation and such. But as a consumer, what we like to see is something that's simplified as a one-call basis. And what we did in our previous home in Menlo Park was we did with the pioneer in the program, I think, was Solar City. And we did a Solar City lease program where cost you nothing. You make one phone call. They handle all the financing, the installation, the engineering, and they also guarantee you the output, which made it really easy for us as a consumer. And then when we went to sell the house, because we currently live in Santa Cruz now, it was actually really nice because it actually helped our house become more competitive in the housing market and actually sold really fast because that's what the next consumer wanted as well, something that was already there in place. And we found that the Solar City option was fantastic because, as I said, you know, we don't want to have to deal with all the paperwork, all the financing.
Yep. Paul, got it. Thanks. Thanks for the offering up that testimonial. I'm going to go right to another caller who wants to know something about the lease program. And then, Danny Kennedy, maybe you can chime in on that. But, Paul, thanks for the call. Chris in San Jose wants to ask about the leasing option as well. Oop, we just bounced to David in Santa Cruz, another Santa Cruz caller. David, go ahead.
Yeah, I just wanted I'm glad there's some clarity being offered up here between a lease model where you're buying clean solar kilowatt hours and the upfront cash payment to actually own the systems. The academic from Berkeley is mistaken. Even in that model, you do end up paying off the system, albeit the return on investment story is quite long, maybe 10 to 13 years, but people do own their houses for a long amount of time, even in a purchasing model. But let's bring some clarity here. No upfront cost. You're leasing the system, and you're actually paying for clean solar kilowatt hours, and less than what you would pay PG&E. It's right there in the formulas. Now, lastly, please, everybody realize that the fossil fuel industry has been subsidized since Standard Oil put in the first gas station, and it still is today with massive tax breaks. The external costs are never taken into account, i.e. health, detrimental health problems from this stuff. Look at the oil spill right now. I mean, so let's be real here.
Thanks. Yeah, no, thanks. Okay. Got it. Got your point. And I think we all agree, I think, and Todd Woody was making that point earlier, that everyone gets subsidies. I think the question is, where should those subsidies go? What makes sense at this point in time? What are the sources of renewable energy? What's the sort of fair and balanced and logical and economic way for those subsidies to go forward? But before we talk more about that, lots of interest, Danny Kennedy, in the lease option, that makes the most sense. And then Severin Bornstein, why don't you chime in on that point as well? Danny, go ahead.
The lease is a great option for customers. You know, I don't want to chill the company, but Sungevity.com also offers it very easily and without hassle, like Solar City, which pioneered it. And it's a great model for consumers because they don't have to worry about the hardware. We take care of the maintenance and guarantee the performance, as a caller said. And, you know, in our case, it's a 10-year lease. It's a commitment which after that period they can upgrade and get the next thing without the hassle of ownership. And the cost is less per month for most people. And It only rises at a small inflator. It's not the cost of money that we talked about with the property tax assessment model. So it is very good. Just to talk about subsidies for a second, you know, this isn't a subsidy so much as a tax credit driven phenomenon. This leasing possibility is made because of the tax credit the federal government made available, that 30% that Severin mentioned earlier from the feds. And you know, the very important thing here is that the feds don't shift the ground on that. You know, we need all of these programs to reverse all these perverse subsidies we've had for a century with fossil fuels to be committed to for the long term.
Your worry is that by changing the rules on any of these things, whether it's the PACE program or anything else, that it's hard to build an industry and it keeps you from growing in the way you want to grow.
Exactly. Investor security, you know, yeah. We've all heard it before, has been an issue for the renewables industry for 30 years, you know, since Jimmy Carter's time. And they set signals, oh, we'd like you to do these creative things with property tax assessment. Oh, no, we don't. You know, with this tax credit, it's locked into law theoretically till 2016. It really has to stay so that many more thousands of Californians and hopefully millions can benefit from it and save money on their bills.
Severin Bornstein, I don't want to turn you into the Cassandra for the program here, but weigh in, if you would, on the lease option, whether or not the economics of that, in your judgment, makes sense. And then I would like to get your sense of this subsidy question, because I think part of where you may be going in this is that we ought to think about where we aim those, and maybe more of the money ought to go into research and development rather into certain technologies that might not be all the way there yet.
Well, first of all, on the lease, I think that a lease option for some people will be better and for other people will be worse. If the people have a lot of money in the bank, which right now is earning about 0% interest, then they're probably better off just buying the system. The lease option does have some real advantages in both the financing and in some cases continuing maintenance and coverage from the installer. So if somebody's going to install solar, they definitely should consider both. I think I heard Danny Kennedy say that tax credits aren't subsidies. I hope I didn't, since they are, just as they are for the fossil fuel companies, where most of their subsidies are also in the form of tax credits. All of these industries are getting subsidized, and what I am arguing for is among renewables, not trying to push fossil fuels, but among renewables, having a more even-handed subsidy program. Obviously, the first best thing we should do is actually put a tax on fossil fuel energy to reflect the true externalities it is creating. I have become much less optimistic that we're ever going to do that at the scale we would need to. So I think an across-the-board green energy subsidy does make sense. At the same time, we do need to be moving towards much greater funding of research and development, because the fact is that the cost differential between solar and all of the alternative energies and fossil fuels is still very, very large. I'm not optimistic that these alternative technologies are going to really be able to beat coal-fired power anytime for many decades to come, unless we can really have major technological breakthroughs.
Let me hold you there and let Ike Weber get in a response.
Yeah, I think this is an argument I heard very often. And of course, I agree with many of the things Professor Bornstein said, especially I think the carbon tax instead of a carbon cap and trade system would be really a simple way to generate lots of funds to go in the right direction. But where I really want to disagree is, instead of subsidizing the market introduction, we should spend more money on R&D. Definitely, we should spend more money on R&D. But the biggest driving force to bring down the cost of photovoltaics and other renewable energies is not just the money going into R&D, but it's the volume employed in the marketplace. So in the case of PV, in the last 30 years, we can observe that with each doubling of the amount of PV systems installed globally, the cost and the prices came down on the cell level at 20% and on the total system price by 15%.
So it's an economy of scale.
So it's the economy of scale, which is, of course, only possible because of research and development. And this is when it really will reach the levels I have talked about within much less than 20 years.
Let's get back to our callers. Lots of people want to join in our conversation. We're going next to Chris in San Jose. Chris, go ahead.
Hi. Yeah, I agree with a lot that your caller just said, but one of the questions I had, when you lease the system, is the system actually still installed on your house?
Thanks for the call, Chris. Danny Kennedy?
Yes. So at Sungevity, you just, you know, get the design engineering, commit to the lease, and then we'll book the installers for you and manage all of that. And as I say, you know, we own the system, really, with our financier. So we're responsible for its performance. We've guaranteed that for a 10-year period. We'll maintain it as required to meet your needs, and we'll pay you for any differences.
Are there fees that people need to pay attention? I don't know if this is something you've done any reporting on, Todd Woody, or not, but a caller here, or someone who emailed in, rather, Dennis, is writing, we installed solar panels on the roof of our house in Belmont. We were shocked when we received a bill of $1,200 in city fees after being told that the permit was only going to be about $300. Is there a sort of buyer beware factor in here that people need to pay attention
to? This is one of the hurdles to mass adoption. In California, each municipality sets its own fees for installation, and they can range from, you know, $50, $100, up to thousands of dollars. And I think the industry has an effort underway to try to levelize that, have one permitting system.
And so in that sort of case, that might also be then a factor in deciding whether to lease or not, because you wouldn't have some of those fees if they're high in a particular locale.
But potential buyers are do need to pay attention to that and check with their local city.
We haven't gotten to something yet, and I'll get back to our calls in a moment, but this, it's important to talk, I think, some about what may happen politically this November, Todd Woody. There is a ballot initiative that people will be voting on, which would essentially suspend AB 32, California's landmark environmental climate law, which requires that we get to a certain percentage of use of renewables by the year 2020. What's the potential for that in all of this? Because if that goes through and AB 32 is suspended, I would think that would have a huge chilling, literally, effect on solar and any number of other renewable industries.
Yes and no. I mean, the thing to keep in mind is there's other state laws that are driving renewable energy, mainly what's called the Renewable Portfolio Standard, which requires utilities to get 20% of their electricity from renewable sources by end of 2010. And a third by the end of 2020. So that will remain in place regardless. And that's really driving solar. AB 32 requires the state to reduce its greenhouse gas emissions to 1990 levels by 2020, which is very important, which is going to drive a lot of innovation and green jobs as well. But we have other laws that are going to continue regardless.
Is that political uncertainty, though, as a businessman, Danny Kennedy, is that part of what concerns you that, again, if you want venture capitalists to invest in this technology, so forth and so on, harder to make the argument when we're so uncertain about where we're going?
Absolutely. I mean, for the broad sector, the clean economy, as we've called it here in California, this is a big issue. And I hope your listeners are planning to vote no on 23, as the proposition's called, that's been paid for by Texas oil companies. The truth of it is, company like Sungevity came to California because of the broad political milieu, not necessarily AB 32 itself, but all these legislative initiatives to generate support for renewable technologies, energy storage technologies, and so forth. And solar is probably a little bit further ahead than many, but a lot of them will be chilled if that proposition succeeds in November. And that investment security we talked about earlier, you know, that will go away. And this has been the fate of renewables for a long time because we pretend it's still alternative. I don't like the word alternative energy. It's mainstream energy. Millions of people depend on it. Our telecommunications, this radio broadcast is solar powered, probably through satellites in space. You know, this is very much mainstream energy. And the point is that we just need to get the right mix and the right investment strategy.
Yeah, there are, in fact, solar panels on the roof of this building. I don't know whether I assume tax credits or subsidies, as Professor Bornstein accurately calls them, were involved in that as well.
But I meant no cash subsidies, but okay.
Cho in Mill Valley is next. Joe, go ahead.
Yeah, hi. I am a installer of solar systems, and I'm always concerned with the amount of cost that goes into setting up each system with the municipality, with the switching, with the metering, with all these costs. I always wonder, wouldn't we be better off having this done at a more central level somewhere else where each house doesn't have to be set up with its own little mini electricity system?
Joe, interesting point. Danny Kennedy, you want to weigh in?
certainly the paperwork burden, which we talked about before, needs to be gotten away with. You know, it's crazy that every little fiefdom in California can dictate the permitting costs or the fire rules for installing a solar system, because that changes the mix and the cost structure of each installation. And, you know, I'm sure Professor Verber could talk about the fact that in Germany there's like one piece of paper across the country to install, and that's why the 50% of the world's solar, and much a lot of it is to do with that, as well as the feed-in tariff, obviously. But yes, there's need to get rid of the paperwork burden. I'm a big believer in distributed generation, resources at the point of use of electricity, and the cheapest real estate to do that on is actually above your head. You know, the roof space is not needed or wanted for anything else. And, you know, buying a patch of desert or a block down on the corner instead to put a bigger solar array on might sound like it makes some sense because of a small economy of scale at that level, but actually putting it over your head and weatherizing your roof is also very sensible and low cost. It's all of these things. In the future, we will see all of them grow as niches in the market, but there's a lot to be said for rooftop distributed solar.
I want to come back to Professor Bornstein's point, which I don't think we've adequately heard a response to. Professor, perhaps you can do that. That we're putting too many of our marbles on this kind of solar technology, and that's tilting the scales in a way that really doesn't make sense.
I mean, it is absolutely true. We should do everything we can in all kinds of renewable energies, and we should not lose sight of the big picture. And the big picture is, by the end of the century, we don't have a choice than to be 100% on renewables. And the only question is, can we make this change over quickly enough to avoid the climate catastrophe, or will we do it after the climate catastrophes happen? So we are talking about the technology of the future, and the question is how quickly we introduce it. Among all the ways to create renewable energy, solar energy is practically the only one which is virtually unlimited. You know, we have only limited places for good online wind turbines. We have limited places to collect water energy, geothermal energy. Solar we have everywhere, and we have it limitless. And this is, I think, the real reason why we should emphasize so much solar. And as a matter of fact, I must say, California and the United States right now is losing badly in the global race. In 2010, we will globally install 10,000 megawatts, 10 gigawatt of photovoltaics. The whole California will be maybe 200, if you're lucky, 300. Whole of United States, 500 to 600. So far below what could be expected from a country as rich and as sunshine-filled as United States. And this far behind position we try to remove by things like our InterSolar event here in San Francisco.
And back to our call. Celia joins us next in Sonoma. Celia, go ahead.
Yeah, I want to thank you for the at least touching so far in this discussion on this idea of externalities or opportunity costs. This was the thing that always irritated me in my undergraduate economics classes. But I think that I'd like to hear a little richer discussion on this, because I think if you really do weigh it, the risk of asthma for our kids, our air quality, the risk of some kind of a disaster like the Massey disaster in West Virginia in the coal mine there, when you really put the right price on lives and water and air, how can it be that a rooftop solar is not economically viable? I think the only way is because we're devaluing our future and the lives of our children, and not just about the environment, but human life and the value of human health, because otherwise the math just doesn't seem to add up for me.
Celia, thanks. Thanks for making that point. And it speaks to something that Art in Santa Rosa also writes in about, that, and Art says this, the psychological impact of having solar on suburban and city roofs shouldn't be neglected in this discussion. Seeing solar on the roofs of many more suburban homes would have the impact of reminding Californians that a crisis of enormous proportions, global warming, is manifesting itself more and more year by year, would stimulate us to be part of that solution. Others are making the point that this is something that's sort of more protected. And if there's a solar energy crisis of some sort, it's not going to have the impact that the Gulf oil leak did. As TJ writes from Sunnyvale, seems to me the rooftop solar offers a decentralized power generation that would be of some benefit in the case that we lose one of our central power plants or transmission systems and there's some sort of cascading blockout. So I guess where all this is going, Severin Bornstein, and jump back in on the conversation at this point, is that a lot of people are making kind of a big argument, a sort of big picture argument for why we need to go in this direction.
We do need to go to much more renewable energy. There's no question about that. But we shouldn't be doing everything. And this argument that we should do everything, I think, is just pie in the sky and misses the point. There is limited funding for renewable energy, and there are clearly some technologies that we should not be installing right now. For instance, there's a lot of great work being done on tidal power and wave power, but that's not economic. And we certainly shouldn't be making massive investments to ramp up tidal power right now. We should be working to make the technology better. So it isn't a question of, once you look at the cost of lives and of pollution and all that, of course solar makes sense. It is true that once you look at all those costs, which I think are far larger than our government is recognizing, it makes sense to ramp up renewables and non-greenhouse gas energy. But that doesn't mean every greenhouse gas energy source makes sense. The most efficient ones are where we should be going first while the new technologies are developed. And right now, solar PV on the rooftop is one of the most expensive ways of generating electricity. Doing it on the rooftop of warehouses, where there's much larger economies of scale, where the roofs are much more conducive, and where they don't have to be individually designed house by house, is much more cost-effective. Doing it out in the desert, even with transmission costs, is much more cost-effective. And as far as reliability goes, when there is a power blackout in your neighborhood, your solar system shuts off. Mm. So it does not protect you from a blackout in your area, just so people understand that.
Todd Woody, can you give us any more detail on that larger debate about the sort of that it makes more sense in larger scale operations, commercial, putting about a big solar farm in the desert somewhere versus doing this house by house?
Yeah, I mean, first you have to say, given the state's aggressive renewable energy targets, we have to do everything because we're not going to get there. There are dozens of large-scale solar power plants proposed for the desert, which are now bogged down in environmental disputes and licensing. One big issue there is transmission. Transmission projects, power lines are bringing this power from remote regions to the coast. They're going to cost multiple billions and billions of dollars and have huge environmental impacts of their own, which is why I think you've seen the utilities and the regulators in the state going toward PV solar panels, both on commercial rooftops, small-scale power stations, because essentially you can plug them into the power grid right now.
And back to our – go ahead, quick. Quick point, Professor Weber.
It's a technical issue to the remarks of Sven Bornstein. And this is – today you can already buy inverters which allow to disconnect from the net in case of a blackout. So if you buy the right technology, you can really secure yourself from a blackout. And if you add a battery system, you can even secure this during the nighttime if you want to go this way.
But that is not what most solar systems are.
Well, it depends what the buyer orders at the time of purchase.
Right, but
if
the
somebody,
vast majority of systems,
you know, take the situation in California.
Okay, I'm going to hold you there because it sounds like that is something that you could do, but probably right now most people are not doing. This is one of these shows, by the way, where everyone is waving their arms at me here in the studio just to give our listeners some flavor for what's going on, as well as lots of blinking lights and about 40 million emails sitting on top of me. Danny Kennedy, go ahead.
Just on the pick a winners thing, you know, let the market choose. The political economy out there is selecting photovoltaics, this distributed generating resource that falls free from the sky every day and turns into the magic of cold beer and warm showers and fast cars in the future. That's what solar electricity does. And our politicians want it. That's why Schwarzenegger, a Republican government, put all that ratepayer money down to get 1 million solar roofs. And people are choosing it in their thousands. And as the market matures, you know, of course, in Germany, in the southern states, there's all sorts of wind power and there's all sorts of other renewable technologies. But 1 in 8 homes is solar powered. You know, the majority of the solar market is not the big box stores and the big flat commercial roofs or the agricultural desert alternative for the Germans. It's the majority is residential rooftop. So, you know, the market-centric, customer-centric future is the one that saves them money, creates jobs for people in their community, and gives them a sense of security and pride of ownership that they're doing something for the future, which is going solar.
Let's hear from more of our listeners. Ray in Santa Cruz is next. Ray, go ahead. You're on.
Yeah, so I just wanted to mention that the only way that it's really uneconomic is if you keep the constant of the consumption of the consumer, where installing solar really raises awareness of your consumption, and then, like in my case, I'm building an off-grid solar system, and I'm going to reduce my consumption by half to make it affordable. And I wanted to bring that up. It seems like no one's mentioning that.
Ray, thanks. Thanks for the point. So in other words, in your situation, Ray, it's become in part more economic because you're just paying more attention.
Yeah, I'm paying more attention, and it's not economic as long as I keep burning a ton of energy that I don't need to be burning. So I'm looking at my consumption, which is like a paradigm shift as far as usage goes, which is what I think is necessary to really change the energy environment of the future.
Right, thanks. Thanks for the observation.
There's a lot of behavioral evidence that people start to measure and manage their electricity after they get a solar system. Yeah. It's like the gateway drug to energy efficiency.
Here's a number of comments that I want to just see if I can skip through a few from our listeners. Rick in San Jose writes, I installed a 2.5 kilowatt system on my home by using equity to pay for the capital. The rebates available made it quite attractive. I sized the system for the sweet spot in that offset so that all my high-cost electricity would be affected, and now only pay for about 25% of my monthly use at the baseline rate. The cost that I paid to PG&E for electricity, I now pay on my equity account. So it's contributing to the equity in his home is the argument that Rick is making. Jim writes, I've had photovoltaic panels on my roof for about 5 or 6 years. My system is just big enough to bring me under the baseline. I've already broken even. And Allison writes, the average production cost is low, but doesn't the marginal cost, peak power plant cost, become much higher than 20 cents per kilowatt hour? This occurs during the summertime sunny days, which is when photovoltaic solar generates the most energy. This question then again on Todd Woody on the time of use, that solar makes sense because
it does tend to coincide with peak electricity demand. I think what most people don't realize is that utilities spend billions of dollars building peaker plants that sit idle most of the year. In fact, a PG&E executive recently told me that they have plants that only operate 50 hours a year.
To handle that peak period.
Yeah, so when it's July, we have a heat wave, everyone turns their air conditioner on at the same time. Yeah. They fire up those plants to prevent brownouts or blackouts. Mm-hmm. But it's an enormous capital cost for utilities.
And just a last word from you, Todd, on what you're going to continue to cover as this issue seems to be getting heated up, literally, and generating more attention. What are the sort of key parts of this debate that you think are going to unfold in the coming months?
Well, I think with the PACE debate, you're seeing enormous political pressure build on Fannie and Freddie to reverse their position. You have the lawsuit yesterday filed by the Attorney General. Yesterday, also, the head of the California Public Utilities Commission wrote a letter to the California congressional delegation asking them to take legislative action. You've got almost this broad coalition of Republicans and Democrats calling for a reversal.
And then we've got a little election coming in November, which may have something to say about this as well. We are out of time. Thanks all very much for being part of our program. Todd Woody, journalist, covers these issues for both the New York Times and the LA Times. Severin Bornstein at the University of California, Berkeley's Haas School of Business. Eike Weber, the director of the Fraunhofer Institute for Solar Energy Systems in Germany, and Danny Kennedy, president and co-founder of Sungevity. Thanks all very much for being part of our program. Forum is produced by Kevin Guillory and Judy Campbell. Our senior editor is Dan Zoll. Howard Gelman is our engineer. Raul Ramirez, our executive producer. I'm Dave Iverson, and this is Forum on KQED.
Funds for the production of Forum are provided by the members of KQED Public Radio and the Claude and Louise Rosenberg Jr. Family Foundation.